256-2001. Go online to WORTFM.org/donate or go through the app and stay with us for local news. And you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
The time is now 6 p.m. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, March the 5th, 2025. I'm your host, Robert McClure. My co-host, Vicki Iden, will be joining me shortly. In tonight's news, Wisconsin higher education leaders are bracing themselves as immigration and custom enforcement arrests are now permitted on U.S. campuses. A candidate running for city council urges Southside voters to stay engaged in local politics. And in the second half, we'll discuss a recent memo from UW-Madison leaders advising a drop in grad school admission, revisit some headlines from 60 years ago today, and I'll talk at great length about today's storm. So stay tuned, all that and more coming up, but first we'll go live to London for a bulletin of news from the BBC.
BBC News, hello, I'm Eileen McHugh. President Emmanuel Macron has warned that Russia has become a clear threat to France and Europe, and big decisions must be made on defence and security. He was speaking during a televised address.
Russia has become, when I'm talking to you, and for the years to come, is a threat for France and for Europe. I regret it most profoundly, but I am persuaded that peace will come to our continent with Russia, which has become pacified and peaceful, but the situation that we must deal with the situation as it is now.
Mr. Macron also said he'd open a debate on whether to extend the protection of France's nuclear deterrent to European allies. Here's Hugh Schofield.
There were no great revelations, there were no announcement or promises or commitments, but it was an address of preparation, if you like, to the people to make sure that they are on side and understand what is happening and understand that there are decisions that will be taken in the coming days and weeks which will have a huge impact on them and maybe on their ordinary lives. I mean, part of all of this, of course, is the huge commitment to boosting defence spending, some of which may come through raised borrowing at a European level, but some of which will have to come through budgetary changes in France.
The United States has confirmed that it stopped sharing intelligence with Ukraine at the same time it suspended military aid after last week's angry encounter between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House. It'll now be harder for Ukraine to defend its cities against Russia. James Waterhouse is in Kyiv.
We are seeing a chasm between what is being said politically and what is happening here. The pausing of American aid was bad enough for Ukraine, a gradual chokehold on its continued defence against Russia's full-scale invasion. The pausing of intelligence, well, where I am now, it's American information which helps detect incoming drones and missiles in aerial assaults that happen every night. It is American information and intel that helps Ukrainian troops target invading Russian forces with missile strikes. But the question being asked by Ukrainians is how far Donald Trump is willing to go with this political levering that amounts to a reckless gamble with Ukraine's future.
President Trump has said Hamas should immediately release all the hostages still held in Gaza, threatening dire consequences if it does not. He also called on Hamas leaders to leave the Palestinian enclave. Writing on social media, the American president warned the people of Gaza that if they held hostages, they would be killed. The White House press secretary has announced the Trump administration will grant one-month tariff exemptions on cars being imported from Canada and Mexico. It comes after warnings that import taxes could cut a third of North American vehicle production. This is the latest world news from the BBC. The US Vice President J.D. Vance has said a military response is needed to combat Mexican drug cartels, who he said were using drone technology to penetrate the US southern border. But he said the Trump administration didn't intend to send US troops into Mexico. Mr. Vance was visiting a border point in Texas with the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth.
From the Defense Department, we've watched for a couple of decades other people's borders being secured while ours was open for an invasion of drugs and of violence and of chaos. The Defense Department has assets that we can bring to bear, not just troops, not just surveillance, not just equipment, but actual planning and capabilities that enhance what Border Patrol is already doing.
The right-wing social media influencer Andrew Tate, who faces rape and human trafficking charges in Romania, says he will return there in a few days' time from the US state of Florida. On Tuesday, legal authorities there opened a criminal investigation into his activities and those of his brother, Tristan. The self-declared misogynists, who are British and American citizens, flew to Florida last week. Scientists in Britain say they have discovered how the drug aspirin may help the immune system fight cancer cells. Researchers at the University of Cambridge made the discovery while experimenting with mice. They're hoping this could lead to cancer patients being prescribed the drug, but they've advised sufferers against taking aspirin for now, as the drug comes with risks. Nobel Prize laureate and education activist Malala Yousafzai has returned to her hometown in Pakistan 13 years after surviving an assassination attempt by Islamist militants. During her three-hour visit to Barkana in Shangla district, she went to local education projects backed by her Malala Fund. Ms. Yousafzai said she was overjoyed to be surrounded by mountains. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios in beautiful but snowy and windy downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
Almost half of Wisconsin voters approve of President Donald Trump, 6 weeks into his second term in the Oval Office. That's according to a Marquette Law School poll released today, which surveyed almost 900 registered Wisconsin voters late last month. President Trump's approval rating is at 92% among Republican voters and 2% among Democrats. It's a similar story on most policy issues, with public opinion consistently falling along party lines. Wisconsin voters are skeptical of Trump's tariff plan, with more than half of respondents saying tariffs hurt the U.S. economy, but a majority of Republican voters side with the president in believing the opposite. Public opinion is more closely divided on Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. 53% say the department is disrupting government programs, while 47% say it's properly carrying out Trump's agenda. Meanwhile, in state politics, many Wisconsin voters still don't know enough to form an opinion about either candidate running this spring for state Supreme Court. Republican Brad Schimmel has more name recognition than Democrat Susan Crawford, the poll finds. Schimmel's campaign has also spent more on advertising so far, at $14 million to Crawford's $13.2 million. The race is expected to take the top spot as the most expensive court election in U.S. history. Wisconsin voters are also unfamiliar with the candidates running for state superintendent of schools, though they have a more favorable opinion of challenger Brittany Kinzer than of incumbent Jill Underley.
Governor Tony Evers slammed President Trump in a statement today following the news that his administration is planning to cut up to 80,000 employees from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. An internal memo sent out yesterday to top-level officials at the VA outlined their objective to return to 2019 staffing levels. Meeting that goal would require sweeping layoffs in the tens of thousands since the agency expanded significantly under the Biden administration. Yesterday's memo urges VA officials to cooperate with Elon Musk's DOGE and, quote, move out aggressively, unquote. The Trump administration has already fired almost 6,000 veterans, a historically high figure that Governor Evers cited in his statement today. Evers writes that the layoffs at the VA would betray the country's promise to support and protect veterans.
Another inmate has died at Waupun Correctional Institution, the state's oldest prison. Damian Evans, age 23, died yesterday at the facility. No further details are publicly available at this time. Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt tells the Associated Press that they're investigating Evans' death, the seventh that's occurred at the prison since 2023. Following an investigation of those deaths last year, Waupun's former warden and several staff members were charged with misconduct and felony inmate abuse. Meanwhile, Governor Evers' budget proposal includes a $500,000 plan to revamp Wisconsin's prison system. The plan includes shutting down another aging state prison, Green Bay Correctional Institution. But Waupun would remain open and, after extensive renovations, serve as a so-called vocational village that prepares inmates to join the workforce upon their release. Republican lawmakers are unlikely to approve the governor's prison reform plan as is, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says his budget proposal is a non-starter.
On a more local level, the Dane County Sheriff's Office is sounding the alarm on a phone scam targeting family members of folks incarcerated at the county jail. According to a statement from the Sheriff's Office released today, someone posing as a sergeant contacted a family member yesterday trying to collect fees for an ankle monitoring program. The scammer told the family member that once the payment was made, their loved one would be released from jail. The Sheriff's Office emphasized in today's statement that they don't call family members asking them to pay fees, nor do they offer electronic monitoring for individuals who haven't been sentenced. If you have received one of these scam calls and provided a payment, you can contact your local authorities for help.
The City of Madison continues to track progress on their goal to add 15,000 new homes to the housing market by 2030. Madison rentals have a vacancy rate of 3%, and vacancy is even lower for owner-occupied homes, driving up competition and prices. Meanwhile, the city is expected to add more than 9,000 new households by 2030. In order to meet those challenges, the city has set the goal to create 15,000 new homes over the next 5 years. Also part of that goal, ensuring that at least a quarter of those new homes remain affordable in the long term. 350 new homes have been added to the City of Madison's housing market since the start of this year. That's according to updated data in the city's housing tracker, showing that 245 move-in-ready homes were completed last month. More than 4,300 new homes are currently under construction in the city, with more than 800 of those set for sale below market rate prices once they're completed.
And those were your local news headlines. As you know, this local news is not sponsored by commercial interests, and it's only possible to do that because it's a community radio station that we have here. And we have Nicole Alley and Amy Lutzky in the studio next door to encourage you to support that station.
Yes, thank you, Rob. Amy and I are here to ask you to give and help support your local news and getting those very important things on the air. It's always great to hear about all the new homes and things like that and keep informed about our local happenings. You can call us 608-256-2001. Go online to wortfm.org/donate or go through the app and make your pledge now and show your support for local news.
Yeah, the local news crew is something that I wasn't really aware of before I volunteered here and impresses me immensely. And the fact that they go out and go to things like the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention to report back to us directly. We don't have to hear that information funneled through any corporate sponsored or owned news. Our own news team is out there, and they're also an award-winning news team. Every year they pick up awards for various stories and reporting that they do. So it's an impressive group and an important part of WORT's programming.
Oh, yes. That our local the news team downstairs is fabulous. All the headline writers, all of the reporters that go out there, the people who are writing the headlines you just heard, and to the director and things like that. So we want to keep them going, and we really need your support in doing that. So call us 608-256-2001. Go online, wortfm.org, or go through the app and show your support for your local news here in Madison. And we would greatly appreciate that. We greatly appreciate any donors giving us a call right now. So 608-256-2001, and we'll go back to the news.
Thanks to a recent policy change by the Trump administration, ICE is now allowed to make arrests on U.S. campuses. Wisconsin is home to more than 16,000 international students, and experts have some advice for campus leaders who want to foster a safe, supportive environment for all. Judith Ruiz Branch of Wisconsin News Connection has more.
On President Donald Trump's second day in office, he rescinded a Biden-era rule barring Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents from making arrests near sensitive locations, including colleges and universities. Now, higher education leaders in Wisconsin and elsewhere are bracing for that possibility. According to the Higher Ed Immigration Portal, nearly 16,000 international students are enrolled at Wisconsin schools. President of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, says campuses are seeing a chilling effect due to hostilities toward international community members.
Higher education should be the bastion of free ideas and academic freedom, because how do you create new things? How do you innovate? How do you imagine if you don't actually create academic freedom?
There are also more than 50,000 first and second generation college students in Wisconsin. Weingarten says the goal is to work for safe, welcoming campus communities with opportunity and dignity for all. An institution's approach to making things safe and welcoming may now change that ICE is allowed on campus. Tanya Broder with the National Immigration Law Center points out that immigration agents can only legally enter public, not private, areas of campus without a warrant.
It's very helpful to plan in advance when you can to have a real procedure for when people are showing up and trying to enter someplace where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Broder suggests establishing and communicating campus policies and protocols for encountering ICE. She adds schools should designate staff to review judicial warrants for validity. The American Federation of Teachers is advising schools to provide legal and mental health support for people who may be affected, offer Know Your Rights training, reaffirm student data and privacy protections, and issue public statements of support. Hattie Gassama with the UndocuBlack Network spoke to higher education leaders on a recent webinar.
I implore us to leverage the power that you have in ensuring that, one, it's communicated that you are protective of your students, and two, to go outside of the campus and be advocates.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A UW-Madison spokesperson clarified the university's position regarding on-campus arrests in a recent email exchange with Isthmus newspaper. Classrooms where instruction is currently taking place are not open to the public, the spokesperson writes. That means if ICE wants to enter any classrooms on campus and take action, they'll need a search warrant. Campus areas that are considered public include waiting areas, lobbies, cafeterias, restrooms, and other common areas.
Noah Lieberman, a B1 developer at UW-Madison, has served on the Democratic Party of Dane County's executive board for the last 8 years. He's challenging incumbent Alder Isidore Knox Jr. this spring, a redux of their matchup in 2023. The election that year resulted in a tie, and it was decided in Alder Knox's favor when his name was drawn from a bag. Lieberman and Alder Knox will face off again on April 1st. Sitting down with our news producer, Faye Parks, Lieberman urged South Madison voters to participate in city politics and support his progressive vision.
Hi, I'm Noah Lieberman. I am a BI developer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've lived in Madison now for 8 years. I have been on the executive board of the Dane County Democratic Party for the last 8 years and was the chair of Madison's Landlord-Tenant Issues Committee.
Now, why are you running for Common Council? What inspires you?
So this is my second time running for Common Council. I ran 2 years ago, and that race ended in an exact tie. After a recount, we had the same number of votes, and the race was determined by pulling a name out of a bag. What that really taught me now is I've been looking at the council for the last 2 years is all of these important decisions being made. And the fact that the person making those decisions for my district literally came down to chance. Our local government is so important, especially now with everything happening on the federal level. Local government has such an immediate impact on our day-to-day lives that we need people serving on the council who are going to stand up for our vulnerable communities, who are going to fight to uphold Madison's progressive ideals, and who are going to do everything in their power to improve the quality of life for people here in Madison. And that is what motivates me. I want to do that work, to find those solutions, to fight for our values. I think that serving on this council is the best way that I can do that for the community.
What is one specific achievement that you want to drive forward if elected in April?
So for me, affordable housing is the number one issue we have to deal with here in Madison. And there is so much focus, and rightly so, on developing more affordable housing. But as somebody who saw a lot of the issues that tenants are facing during my time in the Landlord-Tenant Issues Committee, I think one thing we need to also focus on is making sure that folks who are renting are getting safe, quality, and affordable housing through their rental agreements. Right now, because of preemption laws that were passed during the Walker administration, there isn't a lot we can do just as the council to proactively set regulations on landlords, especially when it comes to how much they charge for rent. But what we can do is make sure that tenants have the resources they need and the processes in place to seek fixes or compensation when they have been mistreated. I think that by encouraging this better treatment of tenants and raising the quality of housing, we'll start to see that competition that will ultimately improve conditions for everyone and drive down prices in the meantime for folks. I think it's only one part of a successful housing strategy, but I do think it's a part that I could really help bring to that next level for us here in Madison.
Yeah, I'd like to speak more on housing, as it's perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone, from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or about $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. You mentioned just now increasing protections for renters. Do you have any additional suggestions to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
The number one thing we need to do is simply to build more housing. My first priority with this is going to be making sure that we can build new housing all across this city. I think we need to look at our zoning laws and make sure that we can build all types of housing all across this city to make it so that folks can live, whether they are looking for an apartment, a townhome, a starter home, or something else, that they are able to find that close to where they need to work and where the rest of their lives are based. And just increasing that supply is going to help us out a lot.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
First off, I want to say that I was a huge supporter of this referendum. I think that the services that our city provides and the employees who do the hard work to make sure that everything our city does functions properly, cutting that would have been a huge mistake, and I'm so glad that the voters of Madison agreed. In terms of what we can do to address our structural deficit going forward, it falls into two camps for me. The first is changes at the state level. That's not something that we as a city have direct control over, but I do think through increased lobbying efforts with the elections coming up with fair maps, hopefully that will put the pressure on Republicans in the Capitol to cooperate and give Madison the shared revenue that it needs in order to function as a city. The second camp, I think, is going to be in finding more equitable ways. So I think that ultimately this would need to come through the use of fees. And I think that we can use these fees not just as a revenue gathering method, but also as a policy setting method to pursue some of the goals that Madison has in terms of protecting the environment, ensuring a better quality of air and water, and in terms of promoting the values of social justice and fairness that we have.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Holders have two priorities to their constituents in their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
I think this is a really terrific question, but I would actually take it one step further because I think there are so many more groups that we are responsible to that go beyond just the city or our district as a whole. As I mentioned before, there are so many communities that are coming under direct attack from Donald Trump, whether that be transgender individuals, immigrants, people seeking reproductive health care. There are communities within our districts, within the city, that will need special attention and protection over the next 4 years. So that would be my first priority, was making sure that I am getting those viewpoints from as many different sources as possible. Now, when it comes to pursuing an actual policy, something that would be good for the city's overall goals, but may not be popular with, you know, in the case of new development, with neighbors who are going to have to deal with that construction or to changing sight lines or things like that, I think that it's important to remember that our city is more than just its boundaries, that our city is so well regarded because of the principles we stand by. And I think that we should be doing everything we can to help mitigate the problems that are being caused for those impacted, for those who don't want to see a certain development or policy take place. But ultimately, we do have to recognize that the duty of local government is to care for everyone, and especially the least advantaged among us. And so if there is a policy that I think is going to do well to serve these vulnerable communities, these disadvantaged groups, I think that making sure my constituents know that I hear their concerns, but understand where I'm coming from and why I would be supporting that policy, hopefully that can lead to a better dialogue and to an understanding of why things are happening the way that they are.
Noah Lieberman will be on the April 1st ballot. He's challenging incumbent Alder Isidore Knox Jr., a redux of their matchup in 2023. You can learn more about Noah Lieberman on his website, noahforcouncil.com. That's noahforcouncil.com.
It's now 6:26 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We turn now to two special guests in the studio, Nicole Alley and Amy Litsky, who want to tell you a little something about the WORT Pledge Drive.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm Nicole, and I've got Amy here for the Pledge Drive. And we're still here waiting to hear from you, 608-256-2001, or online, WORTFM.org, or go through that app. And if you decide to become a wonderful pledger, and you are a new pledger, or a lapsed one coming bound back to us, your pledge will be matched for this Pledge Drive, which is an incredibly generous thing from one of our other donors. So yes, give us a call, 608-256-2001, or go online to WORTFM.org. And I see Amy here looking over all of our nifty thank you gifts.
Well, yeah, if you were distressed by the weather today, yes. You might want to pledge at the 89.9 level and pick yes. up the fabulous WORT umbrella. It's kind of an interesting design, black with a cheery blue interior. So that would have maybe helped today, except it was a little windy. So so perhaps the beanie, the rib knit yes. winter hat would have been more appreciated.
It does look like that umbrella does flip inside of itself. So you could have at least seen the pretty blue side a couple times today while you're yeah. fighting against it. But I think another cool thing at the $150 level are those House of Marley headphones. I heard a Sunday host talk about those and how wonderful of quality they are. So we've got a lot of cool thank you gifts up there for you. And, you know, also just giving is a great gift in and of itself, and helping support your community radio station. You're listening right now to the live local news and all the important stories, and getting those interviews of the local politicians running. And Faye has done a fabulous job doing that. I love hearing her reporting on that. So give us a call, 608-256-2001, or go online to WORTFM.org, and we will get back to the news.
And you are listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison's community radio station. Stay with us, a lot more coming at you in the second half of the show. We'll discuss a recent memo from UW-Madison leaders advising a drop in grad school admissions. We'll travel back in time to 1965 this week, and I'll give you all the details on this passing storm and tell you how warm it's going to get next week.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
WORT, thanks its listener sponsors, and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. President Macron has warned that Russia has become a clear threat to France and Europe. In a televised address, he said Europe had to be prepared for the possibility that the United States would not remain on its side. He raised the possibility of extending French nuclear deterrence to allies. The US has confirmed that it has suspended intelligence sharing with Ukraine on top of the pause in military assistance. The decision will make it harder for Ukraine to defend its cities and strike Russian targets. President Trump has issued an ultimatum to Hamas and the population of Gaza, saying they will face death if they don't release the remaining Israeli hostages. In a social media post, he said he was sending Israel everything it needed to finish the job. The Bosnian Serb leader, Milorad Dodik, has ratified legislation banning the national police and judiciary from the majority Serb region. It follows a court ruling against him for defying Bosnia's international high representative. Syria's foreign minister has vowed to rid the country of the chemical weapons stockpiled by the ousted president Bashar al-Assad. He said Syria would need international help to dispose of the weapons. The right-wing social media influencer Andrew Tate says he'll soon return from Florida to Romania, where he and his brother are facing charges of rape and human trafficking. It comes a day after the authorities in Florida opened their own criminal investigation. The Nobel Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai has returned to her hometown in Pakistan 13 years after she survived being shot in the head by Islamist militants. The education campaigner visited local projects backed by her Malala Fund. And scientists in Britain have found that the drug aspirin may help stop some cancers from spreading. Animal experiments show the cheap painkiller enhanced the ability of the immune system to fight back. BBC News.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. I'm Robert McClure here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us here on the 6 p.m. local news.
Up next is Cardinal Call, our weekly segment featuring news from the UW-Madison campus. Citing federal funding uncertainty, UW-Madison leaders issued a memo late last month to grad school deans advising them to lower their admissions numbers. Host Ted Hingstrom sat down with Daily Cardinal staff writer Wanwa Amat to learn more.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
On February 23rd, University of Wisconsin Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Charles Isabel Jr. and Dean of the Graduate School William Karpus issued a memo to graduate school deans advising them to decrease the number of grad students accepted into their programs. Today, we're joined by Daily Cardinal staff writer Wanwa Amat to discuss the memo while we talk about her recent story, UW-Madison recommends lowering amount of future admitted graduate students as NIH funding remains in limbo. Welcome, Wanwa.
Thank you.
Can you give us some background on what this memo is?
Last week, Provost and Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Charles Isabel and then also the Dean of the Graduate School, William Karpus, they sent a memo to graduate school deans and they advised them to consider decreasing the number of future students admitted to graduate programs following the uncertainty of the NIH funding cuts.
What will these funding cuts target?
These funding cuts usually go into the administrative side of research. So, I mean, it could cut some salaries for some workers, lab equipment, things like that that help the labs operate. That's really what these cuts are targeting.
What, if anything, have colleges at UW-Madison already done to address them?
There's another letter that was sent the next day after this memo issued by the provost from the dean and director of the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. And so Glenda Gillespie, she basically said in this letter that principal investigators, so basically the top people in research labs, she advised them to exercise more caution when deciding to use funds in these research labs because, you know, spending can get a lot more tight. They don't know if NIH is going to, you know, help fund these research labs. So she's basically saying that they need to exercise more caution. And then she's also saying that she's been talking with congressmen and also university presidents to help talk about the uncertainties.
Has there been any pushback from the UW community to the memo or any response from the university?
Yeah, the Teachers Assistance Association, or the TAA, which is a graduate student union here at UW, they have criticized the response from the university because they feel that this university response is not including graduate students in enough, even though, you know, this is a potential policy that will affect graduate students. I spoke with Maddie Topf, the co-president of the TAA, and, you know, she basically told me that she was disappointed in the university's response and that, you know, she would love to be, she and along with the TAA would love to be included in more meetings. You know, she told me that allegedly the university does not want to meet with TAA since Mnuchin took office. And so she thinks that, you know, because graduate students might be in a spot of uncertainty now that these funding cuts might go through, that the university needs to coordinate more with graduate student workers.
You also touched a little bit on some effects that could spring up in the future. What are they?
Yeah, so UW-Madison is a very high research university. We're an R1 university. You know, we do billions of dollars in research. So this could have an effect on future admission cycles. I mean, if you think about the level of research that, you know, graduate programs here at UW have, I mean, we are among some of the top research institutions like Harvard and MIT and UMichigan. And so if these cuts go through, they could potentially affect graduate students and also the research enterprise that makes UW-Madison such a prestigious university to many students here and around the world.
Wanwa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hinkstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
It's now 6:38 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We turn now for a report from you and our pledge drive. What's the news, Nicole and Amy?
The news is we are still waiting to hear from somebody calling in 608-256-2001 or going online to WORTFM.org, going through the app. No time like the present to give us a call. Show your support for your local news and things like the Cardinal Call and all these wonderful features that are in the back half of our news shows. I know I am biased towards that Thursday night, but fishy business, my goodness. I don't fish, but I love that we air a show every other week about the fishing conditions around Madison and things like that. And also important ones like, yeah, we're going to go into the weather here soon. And that's an important thing because like days like today, you need to know what's going on out there so you don't get your, you know, because once you become a donor here, you get that fabulous Ward umbrella. You got to know when you should keep it inside so it doesn't get wrecked.
And our local weatherman, Rob, has on the Wart FM website links to a whole bunch of cool weather stuff so that when he's giving the report, you can follow along and look at the maps and the grids and all this stuff that he's talking about. So it's a pretty special weather forecast we have here.
It really is. And then tonight you'll follow along on that. And while you're there, you'll have another tab open and you'll just go donate to WORTFM.com/donate. And so that Rob will keep telling you the weather and everyone will stay around because Rob, like a lot of people here, is a volunteer. He's coming in on his own time to tell us the weather and keep us well informed. And the both hosts tonight are volunteers. Our board operator is a volunteer. Amy and I are volunteers. So we really rely on the community and volunteers here and you out there supporting us financially during these pledge drives to keep work going. And as one pledger over the weekend said, keep the airwaves interesting. And we can't keep the airwaves interesting if we aren't on the airwaves. So give us a call, 608-256-2001 or online at WORTFM.org. We're doing great here. Pledge drive is really fun. And I think the carbs from that delicious pasta from Just Veggies is starting to kick
in. Yeah. And, you know, if you would call in or go online and pledge, then we could talk about you and your wonderful pledge instead of some of this other stuff, although it's very important that we're telling you this. Because, again, WORT's programming is 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. and a lot of listeners aren't able to listen to all of our shows when they're actually aired. So you can come back later if you can't hear this program when it's actually on the air and listen through the archives that we have. Shows are kept for 2 weeks, I believe.
Yes.
And so you can go back and you can listen. So if you miss something or you're just not available when our news broadcasts are because you're at work or you're doing something, you can go back and you can listen on your own time just by going to the WORT FM website.
Yeah, that is a great point, that those archives are so fun to go back to and just kind of listen in and just kind of pick something, and you'll hear new stuff. And that's a great thing about WORT too, is go back to the archives, you'll find something new and interesting, or tune in anytime and you're going to find something interesting to listen to between our talk and our music. So help keep WORT interesting and on the air. Give us that call, 608-256-2001 or online, WORTFM.org, or go through that app. And now we're going to head on back in and we're going to hear from Rob and his wonderful weather forecast.
It is time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, today's storm played out pretty much as we anticipated. We picked up half an inch of rain yesterday after warm frontal precipitation got underway in the mid-afternoon hours. Then another 54 hundredths of an inch has come down today, with the final 2/10 or so of that coming as snow or mixed precipitation after the sun came up. That was here in Madison anyway. Areas to the north and west got a few additional hours of snow on the front end of this storm this morning, resulting in higher totals there, although comparatively warm ground in many areas after approaching 50 degrees for the past couple of days did mean that a good bit of melting transpired, even to our north. Have a look at the visible satellite image of the upper Midwest that we do indeed have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll see the great swirl of cloud cover that comprises the storm rotating off to our east now over the several hours of that loop there, with its circulation center now off frame up over northern Lake Huron. Behind it to the west, where the skies are starting to clear, you can see the swath of snow left in the storm's wake, stretching from South Dakota down into east Kansas and Missouri, and then eastward from there. A fair bit of that, especially to the south and west, is likely to melt tomorrow, but it is still pretty impressive in its extent. What's also impressive with the storm was the pressure drop that we saw down below 29 inches of mercury this morning, along with an even faster rebound than upward this afternoon on the barometer. The tight pressure gradient indicated by that swing up and down, or down and up, has driven wind speeds well past 40 miles per hour both here and in areas to our west over the past several hours, as dry, heavy, late-season Arctic air pours southward out of Canada. Across much of that same area, the winds aloft up through much of the air column, actually, are parallel to those winds at the ground level, so the faster winds above us are going to continue to add some momentum to the surface winds as we get into the evening hours, although that mixing effect and the gradient itself are going to relax as we go through the overnight period. And then from there, not a whole lot of sensible weather to be concerned about over the coming 5 days particularly. A low pressure system currently visible on the water vapor imagery of the continent, which we also have linked on the weather webpage, approaching the west coast currently, will push across the mountains and spin up a surface circulation that's going to slide eastward through central Illinois on Friday. That will generate a band of snow along the elevated frontal surface on its northern side, but the recent runs of the high-resolution short-range forecast models are indicating that that snow band's likely to remain confined south of the Illinois border, I think, generally, perhaps reaching as far north as southern parts of, say, Lafayette and Greene and Rock counties. And then after that, we'll just be seasonably cool for a couple of days over the weekend before we begin another round of warming next week. How exactly that's going to play out remains unclear at this point, but some run-to-run variation, we have both some run-to-run variation between the various forecast models as well as between them, but it does appear that a generally more active pattern that we've seen much of the winter is going to continue with a fairly decent wave passing in the northern branch of the jet stream, perhaps up across southern Canada along about Tuesday. And if that system stays to our north, it should warm us pretty nicely in the early to midweek period. And then we'll have to see how much cold air return either might or might not transpire behind that system before a second and stronger wave crosses the continent somewhere further south later in the week. That one could be interesting, like this past one. The details, generally speaking, are pretty murky at this point, but if the West Coast upper ridging pattern that we've seen much of the winter is finally starting to break down, it's possible we could see some considerable warming next week, possibly our first thunderstorms as well, since we missed those in this with this current storm. But back to the details for tonight. A remaining light snow shower or two may still pass for another hour or so. That would be likeliest to the north and east of Madison. Otherwise, skies will clear slowly from west-east through the night, with temperatures dropping into the low and mid-20s on very strong and gusty northwesterly winds, up to 20 to 25 miles per hour sustained, still gusting up to 40 or better for another hour or two before then gradually subsiding, down to 10 to 17 miles per hour for the sustained winds by daybreak tomorrow, with the much lighter gusts by that time. Tomorrow should be mostly sunny, with temperatures reaching the upper 30s on backing more westerly winds at 8 to 12 miles per hour. Those winds dropping down to, say, 3 to 7 miles per hour by evening. High and mid-level clouds will start to encroach from the southwest as we get into the overnight period. That'll help restrain the temperature fall, probably just at the upper 20s, despite what'll be near calm winds overnight, veering nominally northeast by morning on Friday. And Friday, high clouds will be thickening up and lowering across especially southern parts of the listing area, but I think without any snow falling from the sky, except perhaps down close to the Illinois border or south from there. Farther north, skies will be higher, ceilings will be higher, but perhaps a bit more broken even as you get north of Madison. Temperatures will hold in the mid-30s on Friday under cloud cover and cool northeasterly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Clouds may scatter east and southeast towards dark, and temperatures will drop to the low 20s in the overnight on more north-to-northwest winds at 4 to 8 miles per hour. And Saturday may see some passing cloud cover with a system that will be passing to our north that day. Otherwise, we should be mostly sunny with a high temperature in the low 40s on westerly winds up at 5 to 10 miles per hour. We'll drop back into the upper 20s overnight, then reach the upper 40s on Sunday as west-to-southwest winds start to pick up a bit more. We should reach 50 degrees, I think, Monday, and we may very well see 60 or better as we get further out into next week. Stay tuned on that score. The temperature at the station down here on Bedford Street currently is 29 degrees. The dew point temperature is 23. Winds are out of the northwest at 22 miles per hour, still gusting well above 40 from time to time. Skies are overcast up at about 2,300 feet, and the barometer is leaping upward currently. It's now up to 29.46 inches of mercury.
We go now to March 1965. As members of the UW community participate in the historic Civil Rights March from Selma to Montgomery, a legendary troubadour comes to town, and Madison's greatest meat magnate dies. Stu Levitan has the news from 60 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
Madison in the 60s, March 1965. On the 14th, close to 1,000 Madison residents, most coming directly from church, mass at the State Street steps of the state capitol for a prayer vigil. They're supporting the civil rights activists marching from Selma to Montgomery. Republican Governor Warren Knowles draws sustained applause when he salutes the demonstrators, including a group that walked almost 2 miles through biting winds from the First Congregational Church on Breeze Terrace. Rabbi Manfred Swarsensky is master of ceremonies for the program, which is organized by the Reverend George Vann, pastor of St. Paul's African Methodist Episcopal Church. The emotional highlight, the eulogy by First Unitarian Society's Reverend Max Gabler for his friend, the Reverend James Reeb of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Boston, died Thursday after being attacked by segregationists in Selma. 2 days later, 3 busloads of Badgers bound for Alabama to support the historic march leave town on a trip arranged by the University Friends of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Chancellor Reuben Fleming says, quote, "I am proud that our students are concerned enough about basic human rights to express their views." And he calls on instructors to treat the 2-day absence as they do any other college ventures which cause temporary absence. But the original destination, Selma, is getting too dangerous. The group heads for Montgomery instead until the situation there also proves so hazardous that SNCC officials ask the 114 students to head for Washington, D.C. instead to protest federal failure to protect the marchers. After talking it over for more than 2 hours at the Chicago bus depot, the group reluctantly agrees to the new plan, which becomes a wintry 4-day vigil in front of the White House. Squatting on snowy, slushy sidewalks isn't much fun, and the students are a bit bitter about not being Alabama-bound. But they draw national media to the cause and feel they've done some good. At night, the students stay at the Lincoln Memorial Congregational Temple, sleeping on the pews and floor. Meanwhile, a chartered flight of about 25 clergy, doctors with donated medical supplies, and law students leaves Madison for Montgomery at about 2 in the morning on St. Patrick's Day. But the Freedom Flyers make it only to Chicago before they're snowbound by a late winter storm and stuck for 24 hours. Still, their spirits stay high. "We shall overcome," one passenger is said to remark, "even the weather." Attorney General Bronson La Follette served as Secretary-Treasurer of the committee, which raised the necessary $3,000. The group finally makes it to Montgomery late Thursday morning, March 18th, staying about 18 hours to observe, assist, and report on the march. Daily Cardinal reporter Eric Newhouse, on the bus initially slated for Selma, reports from Washington, while editor Gail Bensinger and sports editor David Wolfe bear witness in Montgomery. University YMCA program director Jim Sykes is among those walking the last miles into the Capitol. And in campus news this month, March 4th, the Hillel Foundation on Langdon Street hosts a coffee and cookies reception for folk singer Pete Seeger before his performance at the Orpheum that night. It's a fundraiser for the University Friends of SNCC. A minimum contribution of 75 cents is requested. That night, the show's highlight is a driving rendition of Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall that delights the near-capacity crowd. And an important passing to note, Oscar G. Meyer, 76, whose family visit to Madison in 1919 led to the founding of the city's most important private employer of the 20th century, dies in his sleep of a heart attack at his home in Evanston, Illinois, on March 5th. Meyer, then the general manager of his father's Chicago packing plant, was here to visit his brother-in-law, banker Frederick W. Sir. One day, it was too rainy to go for a drive, Sir told him there was an auction of a failed meatpacking co-op near the sewage plant on the northeast side of town. Meyer had been looking for a rural slaughterhouse to decentralize his operations, and he liked what he saw. His father, Oscar F. Meyer, authorized him to offer $300,000 for the facility, which the co-op members overwhelmingly accepted. A few months later, the company subsidized the extension of streetcar tracks from the east side to the plant so its workers could get to the remote site. It also built 50 modest homes for workers. Meyer became chairman and moved the company headquarters to Madison upon his father's death at age 95 in 1955. At the time, the company employed close to 5,000 workers, about 1/3 of the city's entire industrial workforce. Meyer and several executives, especially Alfred C. Bowles, also became important local philanthropists. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported, pledge-driving WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
The time is now 6:55, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT, produced by volunteers on a non-commercial basis. And we're going to turn the microphones over one more time to Nicole and Amy to ask you to support this volunteer independent effort.
Yes, thank you so much. We cannot do this without our volunteers and without your support by calling in to 608-256-2001 or going online to WORTFM.org or go through that app. And we can thank, from the last hour, Shirley for being a donor. And Shirley, somebody else would like to join her in supporting their live local news and Democracy Now by giving us that call and talking to Vicky out there. Thank you so much, Vicky, for being our receptionist and phone answerer during this time. And thank you still for listening. You know, if you can't give, we still appreciate you supporting us by just supporting us. We really appreciate that. Spread the word. Tell your friends that live local news here on WORT is important to you. And you can show us that monetarily by calling 608-256-2001 or going online, wordfm.org.
Did you like that little Shirley? We would like to donate to WORT.
We thought of that ourselves. We're pretty good.
Yeah. the carb fog lifted.
Melon Floyd's replacement.
Oh, gosh. don't speak that. We could never replace Melon Floyd.
No way. But we could ask you to either call us at 608-256-2001 or log on to wardfm.org and find that orange donate button at the top. And if you donate online, you can pay with your credit card right away.
Yes.
And that's a nice little handy thing to be able to do online.
But, you know, I think maybe these people are just waiting for Query to come up next. Probably. And give all their money during that fabulous time on the radio too. So definitely stay here with Ward FM. You can just keep it on all the time and find so many different cool shows, so many wonderful talk, news, radio stuff, music. Carp's coming back.
Literally anything you can think of that you would want to listen to is probably available on WORT.
Yes.
So if you have not delved into all of the programming that this station has, you should check it out because the variety and the depth and the, I won't do that, sorry. You're going to hear stuff that you're not going to hear anywhere else. Let's just say that.
Yeah. We keep it interesting here at Wart. So yes, call 608-256-2001 or go online to wartfm.org.
Keep those calls coming at 608-256-2001 and keep those web donations coming too at wort.org/donate. Thank you for supporting the WORT live local news at 6 p.m. Monday through Thursday nights. Your reporter this evening was Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection. Special thanks to feature contributors Ted Hingstrom, Oliver Gerhartz, and Stu Levitan. Engineer Katie Gergella got the news on the air. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shali Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Vicki Iden.
And I'm your host, Robert McClure. Yes, thanks to all of you who have pledged to support this station and this independent, non-commercial news over the past week and tonight as well. It's hard to emphasize the importance in a time like this to keep your news and information independent of commercial influence. Keep those calls coming at 256-2001. Stay tuned next for Query, followed by This Way Out at 7:30, and we'll be back in your ears with tomorrow's news tomorrow night at 6. Until then, good night.
Yeah, WORT Madison.
Do you find yourself more enraged with every news headline?
Do you have crippling anxiety when you see pictures of starving polar bears on melting icebergs?
Are you shaking your fists at every new threat to bodily autonomy?
If you answered yes to these questions, we have an answer for you. Her Turn, WORT's Feminist News, airs every Sunday at 11 a.m., and the Collective is looking for new volunteers to join us.
No previous experience needed, just a commitment to feminist news and a willingness to bring more women's voices to the radio. Call 608-256-2001 and say you want to volunteer on Her Turn.
Turn your anger into action. Turn your anxiety into hopefulness. Turn your discouragement into power. Volunteer with Her Turn right here on WORT Madison and make your woman's voice heard.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Query. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Vicki Kenyon. I use she, her pronouns. We're so glad you're here tonight. I got a sidekick with me tonight.
Hi, everybody. This is Kat Rhapsody. I also use they, them pronouns, and I'm happy to be here on Query with you tonight.
Hey, let's start things off, since it's a pledge drive show. Well, let's ring the bell.
Yeah.
Go ahead. We got a new pledge.
Great. We have a pledge from Nancy Garnier.
Yes. First time pledger, long time listener.
And looks like we are going with the Progressive Magazine subscription. Congrats on that. And thank you for your donation. First time, which means it is going to be